With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Propaganda versus the truth. You're with Swedish-British journalist Pelle Nyroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to the Pelle Nyroth-Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon. It's really quite shocking to see those pictures and headlines of what's going on in Gaza, the massacres and the hospital deaths. I just, before I came on the show, I did a quick glance at the Scandinavian and German headlines in their main newspapers, and there's not a word about Gaza unless you scroll down very, very far. The main headline in the Aftenposten, which is Norway's main newspaper, is the opening of a new burger bar somewhere in Oslo. Quite incredible, and some other local domestic sports issue. Our first guest, Glenn Diesner, is a top academic and Norwegian and Russia watcher who has criticized the Norwegian media as being more or less garbage, I mean, in the issues of the world. He's a returning guest, and he is one of the top experts on Russia, I'd say, of the realist tradition, and much praised by people like John Mearsheimer. We'll get to that in a moment. We've got Lars Hedegaard, who's a Danish professor, historian, and journalist, and founder of the Free Speech Society in Denmark. His critical insights about the Quran set off a trend in Scandinavia, and he survived murder attempts. One of his best friends, Lars Vilks, a Swedish cartoonist, was not so lucky and died in a very suspicious crash on the E4 motorway. I knew Lars Vilks as well, and it was a very shocking event. And we'll have a chance to talk about the whys and wherefores of that mysterious death. On our second hour, we've got Grant Smith, who's a former US military infantryman and author of The Radical American Mind on Substack. He'll tell us all about veterans groupings in the United States and how they feel about Trump and the Pfizer legislation, which is totalitarian, and also the implementation of vaccines in the military, which is compulsory and led to a large exodus of people with independent mindedness from that institution. Finally, we've got Scott McConnell, founding editor of American Conservative, which I can honestly say, I'm not just saying it because he's about to appear, is one of the best American magazines out there. It's in the paleoconservative tradition, which is anti-interventionist and moderate in many of its views. It's got nice cartoons, typefaces, photos, etc. Many Americans' magazines are beautifully designed and sort of posh, I'd say, and elegantly written like New York and Atlantic. But I mean, their political wisdom, their political understanding and nous is just way off completely. But American Conservatives is great. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm just going to make an excursion into Scandinavian literature for a couple of minutes because my first two guests are Scandinavian. And we've got Henrik Ibsen, of course, who was the top playwright in Scandinavia. One of his most famous plays is Enemies of the People. And both my first two guests would possibly identify with the hero of that. And I sometimes do it too. A Stockman is a medical doctor who warns of contamination of the water supply in a Norwegian town in the late 19th century. The problem is no one believes him, and he gets more and more desperate. He gets a commission to get an article published in a newspaper. But having weighed the pros and cons of upsetting vested interests, they choose not to publish it because they will expose the town's corruption and bring down the ruling elite. So he's finally fed up with all the back and forth about printing or not printing the article. He decides to abandon the press. He calls instead for a town meeting. He rants and speaks to the public about how it's obvious that their health is being harmed by this contaminated water supply. But instead of listening to him, they think he's a lunatic. And the play ends on a sort of somber note of Dr. Stockman being barricaded into his home with his wife. His wife wants to leave the place, but Dr. Stockman is resolute. He's going to stand alone and for the truth. And this idea of standing for the truth is kind of, to me, the Scandinavians at their best. It's this it's a Lutheran. I mean, Martin Luther stood at the Diet of Worms and said, "Here I stand, I can do no other." And that appeals to me very much. But it's probably precedes that. When Scandinavians are at their best, there's a, I think it's a Norman scholar or something, or a French scholar, asked marauding Vikings, they're not just marauders, to say, who's your leader? And one of the Vikings said, we're all leaders. None of us are slaves and we're all leaders. And so Scandinavians at their best, I try to appeal to their best selves, is that it's a country where very few hierarchies and a lot of independent-mindedness. Now, in practice, especially now with this NATO thing, it's absolutely not true. But I always hold this up as an identity that the Scandinavians can hearken back to. And I've been reading a lot about the Revolutionary War in America, having talked to a lot of Americans recently who interested in the founding fathers. And a lot of the texts there talk about the Germanic peoples, the Scandinavians and the Germans, as being models for the kind of freedom that the American Revolutionary Warriors wanted to emulate. Because before World War II and World War I, the Germans had a reputation for being freedom lovers, fighting against the Roman Empire back in year zero. So we mustn't forget that is Scandinavians at their best, and it's our first two guests at their best, representing Scandinavia at their best, all truth tellers, and they don't care if they don't have the masses behind them. Anyway, another truth teller is Basil Valentine, our political editor, and we will have him on again after the quick break. This is the Pelle Nerov Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon.
It's the stuff.
What citizen wouldn't want to make American great again?
People are talking about.
Vilifying MAGA, it's just not going to work.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to the show, Basil Valentine. I was just going to say, speaking of bigging up the Scandinavians there, I had a quick glance at the Scandinavian newspaper headlines. And the main headline in Aftenposten, which is Oslo's biggest newspaper, the sort of prestige paper, like the Guardian of Norway, had a review of a burger bar as its top article. And then I had to scroll down and in Dagens Nyheter, which is Stockholm's equivalent, Stockholm's prestige elite newspaper, they had something. If you scroll down a long, 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 long way, you got an article about Rafah and why the Israelis feel obliged to take it. And as a journalist, the way you phrase the headlines give you an indication to the content. So it was a very pro-Israeli piece. And then the top piece was something irrelevant. So the Scandinavians are not exactly being told the truth here, which a TNT News story did. You saw those shocking pictures. But I guess you're going to talk about that and maybe other things.
Indeed, I am, Pelle. It is our duty to do so, particularly when the corporate media all around the world are doing everything they can to downplay the atrocities. It's really absolutely extraordinary that mass graves, which are still being excavated, as we heard on that report, there are possibly hundreds more bodies buried in the grounds of the Nasser Hospital as well as the Al-Shifa Hospital, and stories of organs being removed, skin being removed, people buried alive. This is as bad as it gets on this planet. These are some of the worst atrocities since the Second World War. And yet the corporate media seem in a rush to report on just about anything else. We've got a clip here now of the United Nations Human Rights Commissioner, Ravina Shamdasani, talking about these atrocities, as we can hear now.
We are horrified also by the destruction of Al-Nasser Medical Complex and Al-Shifa Medical Complex, and the reports of the discovery of mass graves in and around facilities. And we call for independent, effective, transparent investigations into the deaths. Given the prevailing climate of impunity, this should include international investigators. Hospitals are entitled to very special protection under international humanitarian law. And let's be clear, the intentional killing of civilians, detainees, and others who are hors de combat is a war crime. We are stressing the need for international investigations. There's a history here of impunity for gross violations, and so many of them have gone undetected and unreported on. So we feel the need to raise the alarm, because clearly there have been multiple bodies discovered. We don't know how many. There are reports that some of them had their hands tied, which of course indicates serious violations of international human rights law and international humanitarian law. And these need to be subjected to further investigations.
So even in that clip, she uses very sort of milquetoast language to describe the most abysmal crimes that any human being can commit against another one, particularly in such vast numbers. And at the top of the hour in the headlines, we saw White House and State Department spokesman, you know, talking about Israel investigating its own crimes, which is absolutely bizarre. It's like asking Jeffrey Dahmer if he could possibly conduct an investigation into his crimes. And the complicity of Western media is why the students are out on the campuses all across America objecting to genocide. And on both sides of the Atlantic, we see entirely confected, phony, and so-called anti-Semitism stories whipped up and amplified by the media in order to avoid talking about these atrocities. Now, these graves were discovered at the weekend, so you could claim that the story is now 5 days old, but it's ongoing. More bodies are being discovered all the time, and this is something that should dominate their headlines. If this was in the Ukraine and Russia was responsible for this, it would be one of those stories that's plastered across the headlines all week, as indeed it was in the 1990s when the mass grave of Muslim men was found in Srebrenica that led to the ICJ war crimes investigation. But because it's Gaza, because it's the Israelis doing it, it's buried, as you say, at the bottom of the scroll. And it's, you know, it doubles down on the horror. It's as simple as that, Patty.
I just want to say something, which is that I started reading Haaretz and the Times of Israel on a daily basis. And I think we've talked about this before. They're much more honest about what's going on than the British and Scandinavian and European press. Instead, and Die Welt doesn't talk about it. And I found out that, you know, they talk about this Kach party, which was founded in 1971 by Brooklyn-born Rabbi Meir Kahane, who he called for the immediate expulsion of the Palestinians, whom he called dogs in 1984. He wanted to ban all Jewish Gentile marriages and sexual relationships and revoke the Israeli citizenship of non-Jews. His follower, Itamar Ben-Gvir, is formed the Jewish Power Party, an ideological offshoot of Kach. And now he is a security minister in Netanyahu's government. And he, for many years, he had a portrait in his home of the Baruch Goldstein, an American Israeli who killed 40 Palestinians and wounded more than 100 in a shooting massacre as they knelt in prayer at the Hebron's Tomb of the Patriarchs. In the aftermath of the Goldstein's slaughter, Noam Federman, a spokesman for the Kach party, opined the act itself was one of greatness, was a greater act of sanctifying the name of God. Paying homage at Goldstein's funeral, Rabbi Yaakov Peren told mourners that 1 million Arabs are not worth a Jewish fingernail. And then Ben-Gvir has been talking about the execution of Palestinian prisoners to make way for, because the prisoners are filling up with Palestinians, and maybe probably these people are innocent. So, and that's just a sort of a sample of the things you can find about this guy, you know, who is one of Netanyahu's closest ministers. And the Western publics are completely being denied this amazing information.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And those are people that the likes of Rishi Sunak, Tony Blinken, Joe Biden, Ursula von der Leyen support. That's the thing. By supporting the Israeli government, by continuing to provide it with diplomatic cover, by continuing to support its onslaught, they are directly behind the likes of Ben-Gvir. They don't like admitting it. And such is the abysmal state of corporate journalism, they're never put on the spot about it. Wouldn't it be great to see people like Sunak, David Cameron, whoever else, directly questioned about statements by people like Ben-Gvir and his cohorts, directly confronted with the open calls for genocide and asked to condemn them? Because it's all very well talking about cliches like Israel's right to defend itself and all this other garbage. But they pretend to be completely unaware of the wholesale genocidal intent, which is ongoing, by the way. You know, and, as I speak, there is artillery shelling in central Gaza near where those bodies were found, shooting from quadcopters, more artillery shelling, Israeli military showing no signs of slowing down with the attacks. You know, and yet, even that fact, the fact that the shelling is ongoing, is unreported. It's almost as if there's a ceasefire or something. There certainly isn't.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I read a story about a mother who was walking around in the debris or the sort of mounds and looking at the corpses and trying to identify her son by the strange shape of his tooth, which is slightly above the level of the other teeth in the mouth, his front tooth, because the bodies were so decomposed and destroyed that there's no other way of telling. So the little details like that. So, I mean, let's remind ourselves, this is like Bucha on steroids. And Bucha, where there were people who alleged to have been shot by the Russians, although there's two minds about this, because they were Ukrainians and had their hands tied. And you had this armored vehicle driving through a road where you had six or seven bodies lying on either side of the road that hit the headlines for days or weeks. And it excused the fact that Ukraine didn't make a peace with Russia, which could have ended the war with very few casualties, and that they could have kept just the fact that Ukraine didn't make a peace with Russia, which could have ended the war with very few casualties, and that they could have kept Donbass in Ukraine. I mean, so it was a terrible, it was a transformative event in the war on Ukraine. This is a million times worse, and the papers don't even write about it. Anyway,
it is to be hoped that this story will break the dam of Western media complicity in the genocide. It must do. It can't be buried for much longer, such is the scale of it. And it is to be hoped, I mean, I've been saying this for weeks and months, really, that it may provide the tipping point in Western support for the genocide.
Well, let's hope. But thanks a lot, Basil. We'll have you on again in the next hour with more developments. This is the Pelle Nerov Taylor Show, and we're going to go on to our first guest after a very quick break.
Johnny Vedmore, TNT.
It doesn't matter what you think about the Jewish people. If you don't agree with the IDF murdering women and children, then you are an anti-Semite, of course. This is an extremely dangerous game. Once upon a time, that word actually meant something quite powerful. Actually, it caused people to lose their jobs. It led to politicians losing elections. It led to people's lives being ruined, and sometimes even led to jail terms. Now, it leads to people saying, get lost. There is only a certain amount of times that you can accuse people of being something they're not, and in this situation, those times have definitely passed.
Johnny Vedmore on today's News Talk, TNT.
The Light is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
If you're still wearing a cloth or surgical mask around in public, you're guilty of spreading COVID misinformation. It really is that simple. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Nerov Taylor Show. We've got the excellent Glenn Deason, who's a professor at the University of Southeast Norway, an associate editor of Russia and Global Affairs Journal. His main research focuses Russian foreign policy, geoeconomics, conservatism, and Eurasian integration. He's just written The Ukraine War and the Eurasian World Order, which has been praised by the very well-known YouTube personality, but academic, of course, John Mearsheimer, whom many of you know. Deason has written a terrific book about the emerging world order, a must-read for anyone who wants to understand the great shift in global distribution of power, whereas Richard Sackler is probably less known, but is a beautifully observant analyst of Ukrainian affairs, and I can highly recommend his books, A Corrective to Western Mainstream Narratives, providing a powerful conceptual framework for critique, a brilliant foundational work. Welcome to the show, Glenn.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
But I was just talking about Dr. Stockmann in my monologue, this Norwegian hero and truth teller, written about by Ibsen, and comparing you to him. But the Norwegian press have written another hit piece about you. They're not very happy about your work. What have they said about you now, that you're a Putinist or something?
Well, yeah, that's the usual one. You try to call for common sense and diplomacy, and you know, war propaganda 101 is, you know, claim to that they're standing with the enemy. Well, there's a common trend. It's actually one guy all the time has written a bunch of articles in newspaper. He get his friends in the media to write about me, and he, you know, to interview him. He sits on Twitter all along and trying to shame the university as well for, you know, allowing a platform, if you will, for me, because apparently I spread then Russian propaganda. It's one of these formats where they, it's a new form of political propaganda. It's began really in the 1980s, where instead of having directly from government, you whitewash it through this humanitarian organization. So you have 100% funded almost by government. And of course, the National Endowment for Democracy funds this human rights organizations. They only focus on human rights in adversarial countries, and they essentially are able to translate all power politics into a struggle between good versus evil values. So effectively, yes, propaganda. So and it's always the same. If you criticize or ask for caution, self-restraint, then it's condemned, because again, the main narrative now from NATO is, you know, war, weapons are the path to peace. The diplomacy doesn't work. So if you disagree, then these articles are written about you.
I'll talk. Well, we mentioned we won't make Israel and Gaza our main topic of conversation, but because that was our previous conversation with Basil, I'll mention it. But I just want to say something about the Norwegian press, because yesterday I was looking up. There's a website and a paper looking at the countries with the most free press in the world. And America comes up very high, but so does Scandinavia. And I know that Sweden, and I don't know about Norway, has very free formal, a very few rules against press. And the Swedes believe themselves to have a very free press, but there's also quite a conformist climate. And you described Norway, and Norway ranks even higher than Sweden, but it's got a completely garbage media that just writes NATO propaganda. How can Norway be the freest press and have the freest press in the world and yet have such bad journalists? Or such propagandistic press? It's a strange paradox.
Well, this is often why power politics have to be sold as this good versus bad values, because it's especially in other areas, it's quite decent. But as soon as there's a war coming, it's only one side which is permitted. And I think what they do is, you know, these people are convinced that they're fighting the good fight, that, you know, this is a struggle between their righteousness and evil. And, you know, so they have to stick with the narrative in which all counter arguments have to be pushed aside. And by the end of the day, you open the newspaper and it's just every time some Russian soldiers have been struck, it's just this war enthusiasm, celebration. And they all pretty much accepted this idea that there is no room for diplomacy. And what really frightens me is they, you know, there's a lot of criticism of American media, but at least sometimes reports come out. But vital reports, these are never covered at all. And I mean at all. Like one very important example is, you know, right after the Americans toppled the government in Ukraine, the first thing they did was to initiate a partnership with CIA, MI6, and Ukrainian intelligence agencies. This was covered by the New York Times. And, you know, they established all this NATO, no, sorry, CIA military base along the Russian borders and have the, you know, all this, well, essentially partnership against Russia. And this was before they even took back Crimea, the Russians. So this war began with the coup, but and it's all there in black and white, but no single report in media want to mention it. Same as
no one in Norway, yeah. So how do they deal with this whole Gaza thing? Because we've just seen reports of massacres in outside hospitals that make Bucha, which of course was transformative for the campaign against Russia and ending the diplomatic track. This makes it look like a triviality compared to what's going on. How is the? I looked at Aftenposten, as I said to Basil, and there's almost nothing about the Gaza at all or the war there. So how are the Norwegian elite dealing with Israel Gaza?
Well, I would say compared to whom? I think compared to the other countries in the West, I would think it's actually better. I think they have more nuance and you know, put more of the suffering of the Palestinians in the open. You even have criticism from the government. So on the Palestinian issue, I actually think Norwegian government and the media is often more nuanced than its other European counterparts. So, but still, the bar is pretty low, and I think overall, one can agree, disagree, and debate whether or not this is just a massive massacre or an actual genocide, or just I would say ethnic cleansing. But this is nonetheless a horrific tragedy, and one which a lot of the Western countries have supported. They cut back funding for aid, and they increased the military aid to Israel. Even the Americans are, you know, having this crocodile tears, going, "Oh, we're asking the Ukrainians, or the Israelis, to restrain themselves, but meanwhile, they're handing over all the weapons which are used for the killing. They could simply stop supplying the weapons." So I think it's a lot of theatrics. They would like to support Israel in everything they do, but still kind of clean their hands with this massacre and likely genocide which is occurring.
Glenn, we've got to go into a news break just in a second, but after the break I want to talk about this deal that's passed through Congress, which is going to give Ukraine $61 billion and maybe even allow the confiscation of Russian assets, which could be an excuse for war, and the delivery of ATACMS missiles, which is going to allow deep strikes. So escalation upon escalation, just in the time when we thought that maybe there was some sanity in the West, or at least in Washington. We'll talk about that after the news break. This is the Pellinero Taylor Show. We've got Glenn Deason, professor based in Norway, with us back in about a minute or two.
We do have some big news.
Listen up.
Now, TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. Israel has been accused of carrying out field executions in Gaza following the discovery of multiple mass graves in the Palestinian territory. It's been revealed the US is considering turning unused oil rigs in the Pacific Ocean into floating military bases that would be used to fire missiles and resupply US warships. And Moscow has warned it would downgrade relations with Washington if the US confiscates frozen Russian assets.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction, misinformation from the truth. From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio, or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pellinero Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon. We've got Professor Glenn Deason with us, who's a geopolitical expert on Eurasia and has written a book about it. Glenn, so what this is a bill that's just passed in the United States. Is it going to escalate the war, just as we thought? Well, maybe there's some sanity in Washington.
No, it will definitely escalate because, this is a response to the failure of defeating Russia. So everyone now is recognizing that the Ukrainian army is exhausted, is being defeated. And as we saw, at least over the past week and a half, the front lines have now completely collapsed and the Russians are just marching into new villages. So what do you do? Do you do diplomacy or do you escalate? And the answer every time is escalate. And but it won't have a significant impact. I mean, you can't. A key problem is the shortage of manpower. So now there's, of course, talks in Poland and other places, Lithuania, and Americans are also thinking about what to do in terms of expelling, throwing out male refugees who can be sent into the trenches to effectively bring more meat into this war. But you can't just invent an army overnight. So it won't have a decisive or great significance, but it will. It's enough to extend the war a bit, possibly even until the elections in December. In November, which is quite important, as the New York Times has informed us.
I was just one of the interesting things about the Iran attack on Israel. There's an article by Seymour Hersh where he said that the Americans and the Russians coordinated so that the Russians pulled back on Iran and the Americans pulled back on Israel a little bit. Is there that sort of back channel stuff? Because doesn't that suggest that, thankfully, that the Russians and Americans are talking to each other to make sure these things aren't going to escalate into a third world war?
Well, I sincerely hope so, because one of the key challenges is not just that there has been such a huge reckless escalation and that we're possibly on the cusp of a nuclear war, but this is a whole new scenario for us. We're fighting a proxy war, and the rules haven't really been established yet, because again, keep in mind the rhetoric at the beginning, like of the war, because you know, after we toppled the government, we began to supply the weapons. Is this too provocative? Keep in mind, Obama didn't even want to send weapons in 2014 first. He was a bit cautious. They sent the CIA, of course, but didn't want to do it too open because it would be too provocative. But then after the Russians invaded, we began sending some weapons. Is this enough? Does this make us a party to the war? Will this trigger nuclear war? No, okay, let's participate in the war planning. Let's provide intelligence for the Ukrainians. Let's work on strike decisions. Who should we strike? And we do the intelligence, providing them with all this information, you know, the weapons. We even have a huge amount of military advisors now coming down in terms of how to operate these weapons, because they're quite complex weapon systems. You even have the leaks now from the Germans suggesting that Westerners or NATO troops could be involved in actually pulling the trigger as well. So you have all this. And we haven't really delineated, like, where does this make us a participant of the war? What is it that triggers nuclear war? And the rules haven't really been established yet. Keep in mind that, you know, Biden himself said a year or so ago that we can't send F-16s because that would trigger World War III. Well, now we're sending F-16s and also much other powerful weapons, such as the TACMs, which is a huge escalation. This cannot really be overstated. It's quite a dramatic one.
Why is it so? Because, I mean, the British sent their storm shadows, and that was regarded as an escalation, but the Russians managed to control those, I think. Why are the TACMs so different?
Now, they're also very long range, which makes them also quite important, if you will, to the Ukrainians, because now they can begin to strike not just Crimea and the Crimean Bridge, with which NATO wants to destroy, but they can also strike deeper inside Russian territory. They can go for accumulation of forces, logistics points, energy infrastructure. They can go for political targets. There's an abundance of weapon, ammunition depots. There's a lot they can get now within Russian territory. And again, it's the media coverage of this which really strikes me, because keep in mind, the Americans didn't supply the long-range attackams for more than 2 years for a specific reason. It was considered to be way too reckless, too much escalation, something that could trigger a nuclear war. Now they are sending it, so everyone is conforming, and every journalist now, no, it's not an escalation, it's not that dangerous. But why didn't they send it for 2 years then? It's very dishonest. And same as, you know, Anthony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, he used to say that they cannot use these American weapons to target the inside Russian territory, because this could make America a participant of the war. It could trigger a nuclear war as well. Well, what does he say now? No, it's up to the Ukrainians how they want to use these weapons. If they strike inside Russia, you know, it's their prerogative. So, you know, it's not provocative at all. It doesn't make America involved in this war. And anyone who questions, how about what we said last week? It doesn't count anymore. Well, it's Russian propaganda now. So, you know, if you try to discuss it, we will destroy your name, destroy your career. And it's a very hostile, quite disgusting environment in the media.
And of course, you know, the next step is the F-16s. I mean, they've been delayed for a year or two. There's a lot of talk about it, but there's a lot of worries that they would have to take off from Polish or Romanian bases because they're not enough. They're quite sensitive, these planes, and they need proper runways. Has that been, and they'll probably have to be staffed by Western pilots. I mean, that's going to be another huge escalation, isn't it? Is it happening, or is West pulling back on this? Are they refraining from doing something?
I hope they're pulling back. But again, the problem now is the whole political and media sentiment is you have to support everything blindly if you... otherwise, you're a traitor almost. And the problem here is this goes back to the idea, what are the main rules in this proxy war? Because it's slowly breaking one red line after another. So now we're saying, oh, well, now actually NATO soldiers might actually fly the NATO weaponry, which with the NATO weapons, which will use NATO intelligence to strike Russians. So increasingly, the Ukrainians are even cut out of this. And we're going to take off from NATO runways and then attack Russians. And the Russians have said very clearly, once planes take off from NATO runways, those military bases are legitimate targets. And if I would bet anything, and there's a lot of uncertainties in this war, but if I would bet 100% one thing is that the Russians will strike against these NATO bases if they are using them. If these bases are used directly in the war to kill the Russians, I think you can very safely bet that these will be targets of the Russians. And this is because at some point, it's a bit like the Iranians, at some point, the risk of doing nothing is greater than the risk of doing something. Because if you allow the adversary to simply take off from their own airfield with their own pilots and bomb you and you do nothing, you set a very dangerous precedent. And now, why should NATO soldiers take off from Poland and start bombing the Kremlin? What are the rules? So it's important, if there's no pushback, there's no rules. And I wish it was possible to discuss this, but our media, like I said, it's just awful, spineless and awful.
Professor Glendies, and we've got to wind up there, I'm afraid. It's very interesting because I was studying the Versailles Treaty in 1918 and 1919, and a lot of the diplomats were disgusted by the media coverage of before the war and during the First World War, and even on the Versailles Treaty. They said they poisoned all the work of the diplomats. And they said, we've got to legislate against the press in some ways when they were trying to design a new world. But they never did that. So that's something to think about, a very long awareness of the harmful effects of the media in creating wars and fomenting wars. Thank you very much, Glendies, and professor at the University of Southeast Norway, and a returning guest. Hope to talk to you soon again. This is the Pelle Nyroth Daily Show on Friday afternoon.
While serving in Afghanistan, I was hit by sniper fire. The fighting was so intense, the medevac chopper was barely able to land. In the hospital, I was given a 5% chance to live. It's a good thing math wasn't my best subject. Today, I visit classrooms and share my story. I talk to kids about dealing with life's struggles. I tell them, with a little help and a lot of work, that you can overcome any challenge.
DAV helps veterans like Adam get the benefits they've earned. They help more than a million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
I know that some struggles are big and some are small, but they're all struggles, and you have to learn to get through them. With support from DAV, more veterans like me can live their best life. And as a new father, I have one more reason to keep on keeping on. My victory is being there for the next generation.
Adam Alexander, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
She was reading at a second grade level in kindergarten.
Pod force swimming before she was 7.
Finally convinced mom to get her ears pierced in the 3rd grade.
Came in 2nd at her 5th grade spelling bee.
Drill team in the 7th.
And with one stroke of the keyboard.
One click of the mouse.
It's gone.
It's gone.
It's gone.
Report a cyber tip today.
Right now, the forgotten poor are waiting for healing and care, for life-saving medical care, for a chance to live with dignity and hope. They are waiting for Mercy Ships and you. Mercy Ships is the largest floating civilian hospital in the world, with volunteer medical staff and crew who donate their time to save lives. And now, as our newest state-of-the-art hospital ship sets sail, Mercy Ships will double our ability to reach children and adults who need us now.
Without the work of Mercy Ships, these patients don't have another option.
Mercy Ships is answering the call to serve suffering people who have nowhere else to turn. Together, we are going to some of the world's most desperate places and bringing a wave of hope and healing to those who need it most. To learn more about this wave of hope, go to mercyships.org today.
Exposing the deep state and government overreach. You're with Pelle Nyroth Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Nyroth Taylor Show. In my monologue, I was talking about the heroes of Scandinavia standing up for what they believed in, even if the majority was a bit skeptical. We had Glenn Deason on in our as our first guest of the afternoon. We've got Lars Hedegaard, who's Danish, a Danish author, historian, editor, journalist, and critic of Islam. He's established the International Free Press Society in 2009, an extension of the Danish Free Press Society, founded in 2004, of which he served as a chairman until 2014. He He's a very, very well-known person in Scandinavia, especially in Denmark. He sets the tone of the debate on many cultural war issues and on geopolitics, I'd say. He was the subject of an assassination attempt in 2013, but at the age of 70, he managed to fight off the assassin, who I think was a jihadist, and he's since lived in hiding with police protection, which is why we're not more specific about his location in Denmark. One of his friends was killed, Lars Vilks, a man whom I knew, who was an artist who made fun of Islam, and his car crashed into a motorway, the middle of the motorway, he died in a fireball. Horrible to think about. Anyway, I think we've got Lars on the line now. Lars Hedegaard, are you there?
I am, yes.
Yes, I've long wanted to meet you, actually, and talk to you, because I've followed your writings for many years. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Could you speak up a bit?
Yes, of course. Could you perhaps start telling us a sort of a story about the attack on you and who attacked you, and what was the result of that? Let's go back to 2013 and tell us that narrative of why you were, what had happened during the attack and why you were attacked.
What happened in 2013 was that a man came to my house and presented himself as a postman, mailman, said he had the package for me, and I went to the door to fetch it, and he didn't have a package. He had a gun, which he fired at my head and missed, barely missed my head. We then proceeded to engage in a fist fight, and an old-fashioned fist fight, because he could not reload his gun. He ended up fleeing the site and running away, as far as I know, he left the country the same day. So this was a prepared assassination. I then later learned that he was an operative of Islamic State, and later became chief of Islamic State's foreign terrorism. So I suppose that the attempted assassination of me was sort of a rite of passage, proving to his superiors that he was bona fide.
And you've since lived under police protection, haven't you? I mean, you also knew Lars Vilks, who was this artist and sort of amusing provocateur and lefty who believes you can say whatever you want and you should be able to make fun of everything, which I know is very strong in the Danish tradition, not so much in the Swedish one, but he was a Swede. He lived in Skåne, which is near Denmark. So they have some of that cultural residue of Denmark. What happened to him? And do you think it was foul play when the car containing him and his bodyguards crashed into the middle of a motorway?
I don't know. Lars Vilks was a friend of mine. I speculated quite a bit about what happened to him. I find it hard to believe that it could have been an accident without some interference. Very hard to believe that. I mean, he was together with two policemen who were of course trained as to protect Lars Vilks. All of a sudden, the car rammed into the other side of the road, and the car exploded. I don't think it could have happened that way, but I have no proof of that.
I was going to say, I mean, I was reading up a lot on the Julian Assange papers or the WikiLeaks leaks, and one of the most interesting things was the leaks that detailed a project by the CIA to take control of cars remotely by sort of some electronic signal and accelerate the car or take control of the steering or eliminate because all cars are sort of electronic machines now, so these things can be done, and they're all connected to Wi-Fi. And I'm not saying that the CIA did this, but I know they do other things, but not this one in particular. But I mean, it shows that the technology and the means are out there for hostile intelligence agencies to do this sort of thing. So that said, I mean, I know a guy, there's a relative of mine, he's a policeman, actually, and he knows the bodyguards involved. And he said, well, they always drive at 160 kilometers an hour, even though the speed in Sweden is 120, because they're in a rush to get places. And maybe this was just an accident. And I guess we'll never know. But I mean, I thought that Lars Vilks was a true hero of free speech, but less well known than Kurt Vestergaard, who, of course, was the guy behind the whole cartoon scandal in 2006, when Denmark was became a sort of a center of global attention because it made fun of Muhammad. There's a famous picture of Muhammad wearing a turban, which also was like an old-fashioned circular bomb. And you were very much part of the debate in those years, weren't you? You know a lot of the Muslim Islam critics or Muslim ex-Muslim or people who are Quran critics. You know Ibn Warraq, you know Samia Labidi, you know Chador Javan and others. Probably your most famous book is In the House of War. What did you say in that book? And 20 years on, have you had developed those theses, or do you regret some of the things you wrote, or do you feel even more strongly about it? So tell us a little bit about In the House of War.
I don't regret anything I wrote in that book. Quite the contrary, it would have been even better today, I would think. The book was published in 2003, and it created quite a scandal in Denmark, and I think that was that was one of the reasons why I became a persona non grata in Denmark, and was later hounded and persecuted in front of several courts and shot at, etc. But no, I don't regret what I wrote there.
So what are the main theses of the book? Yeah.
Beg your pardon?
What were the main claims? What can you just develop your arguments in the book? You've got 7 minutes to do so.
Well, the argument was that we in the West are now in the house of war, according to Islam, which means that this is the place where Islam has a duty to conquer us and subjugate us. Which is why it was called In the House of War. I tried to prove that by closing sources. And as you know, I'm a historian by training, so I've studied what happens to societies where Islam gains a foothold. And invariably, any time Islam gains a foothold in a non-Muslim country, that is an opening to a war, a secret or subjugated war, or an open war eventually, to subjugate the infidels. So that was the argument in the book.
The intellectual, the political climate has changed quite a lot since, though, because you, as you well know, I think you converted to Judaism, didn't you? And I don't know if you're still Jewish, but do you feel that the widespread sympathy for in Gaza for the Palestinians, do you think that is justified, or do you think Israel shouldn't be getting the bad press it's getting at the moment?
I think that Israel should use all means to eradicate Hamas, and I think that Israel should not bow to criticism about, you know, genocide or whatever. The population of Gaza was manifestly behind Hamas and wanted this war against Israel. So I certainly hope that Israel will not stop its attacks on Rafah. I hope Israel will not stop its war until Hamas is eradicated. That is my take on it.
Mm-hmm. When this jihadist who tried to kill you, was he ever caught? And do you still fear that you might be targeted?
Well, yes, I suppose if they could find me, I'm sure they would love to get rid of me, but day to day I do not go and I don't shiver and fear anything. So, I mean, you can't live that way.
I mean, my view is that maybe your friend Lasvilix was targeted by the Iranians or something, because he was a very public figure and he would have been a real scalp for them. And I don't think it's the sort of thing that Hamas or Hezbollah had the capability to do, but maybe one of the other intelligence agencies. And if they were able to get him, they could get other opponents of Islam in Scandinavia. So when that happened, did you, a lot of your friends among the Islam critics, have they also been targeted, apart from yourself and apart from Lasvilix?
Not to my knowledge. I'm not sure about Lasvilix. Death. Nobody has taken any credit for it, as far as I know. I mean, the Islamic State or Hamas or the Iranians have not said that we did this and we caught him. I mean, that does not really prove anything.
Mm-hmm.
Still find his death troubling, and I cannot believe that it was just an accident. By the way, I must say, you know, there was a sound recording of the incident. You heard about that?
No. We've got 30 seconds left, so could you just tell it in one or two sentences? What does it say?
It said that there was a gunshot.
Right.
That hit his car and caused the accident.
Okay. So there's a gun. Okay, I'm afraid, Lars, we've got to wind up there, but I'll certainly chase that up, actually, because if there was a gunshot that was recorded somehow in association with that crash, which has been was a huge story in Sweden, then that certainly suggests an assassination.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you very much, Lars Hedegaard. Best of luck to you, and we're on to the next guest and the news. This is the Pelle Nerroth Daily Show.